Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Doc Foyle Computer Services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Well, today is the fourth and final day in our climate change series. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Michael Northrup about economics, climate change, and investment. By the way, if you have comments about this series, please go to facebook.com/radiocafe or write me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Would really like to hear your feedback. I'm very happy now to welcome Janie Shermack. She's a professor of economics at the University of New Mexico, and she contributed to the report An Overview of Potential Economic Costs to New Mexico of a Business-as-Usual Approach to Climate Change. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
And we're contributing, and we're continuing in our week-long series on climate change here on the Radio Cafe. And as we've been talking about in some of our other programs, one of the arguments against dealing with climate change is that it's too expensive. Now, in this report, you make a very strong, and if I may say so, pretty scary case that the costs of doing nothing are much, much higher than the costs of doing something now. The report breaks these costs down into various categories, and I thought we could talk about some of them. Let's talk first about energy. In what ways would unchecked climate change increase energy costs?
Well, there would be a couple of ways that I think we could look at the energy-related costs. And the way that the story would go here, of course, is if we have climate change, we will then tend to see the weather events or characteristics that go along with that, including increased temperatures and decreased precipitation, perhaps, and maybe movements in terms of when you would see some of the weather events that we've had in New Mexico. So one of the things that was included in this in terms of the energy-related costs would be the increased cost of cooling in just residential. And so for 2020, I think the residential costs were something like, $209 million is what would have been estimated just simply for cooling costs.
So that's one cost. I think in the long run, we also can't overlook the fact that the fossil fuels that we're using for energy now are finite, and when you start to use up a finite resource, it just becomes more expensive.
Yes. I think you're exactly right. As we see increased scarcity of oil, you would expect the cost of that oil to become, more expensive. Now, one thing that could mitigate this would be additional resources that would be found. An example of that would be within the last few years, there's been quite a lot of interest and changes in the natural gas industry because of shale gases. And so we've actually increased our supplies of natural gas due to shale gases, which are not found in New Mexico, I might add, by the way. But so we will have like a change, basically, in the type of energy that we would see. But the fact of the matter is you have to also put the energy resource, to the type of use that it's being used for. And so you also need to have the changes in the infrastructure and the changes in the capital costs or the capital equipment that would go along with the change in the type of energy that you would be using.
There are also public health costs associated with continuing to burn fossil fuels. For example, some of the other emissions besides CO2 that come from coal plants, and those also have economically calculable public health consequences.
Certainly, I think that's exactly right. And within New Mexico, three things I think that were looked at within this report would be the increase in ground level ozone, costs that would be related to increased heat because of increased temperature, and then costs that would also be associated with changes or increases in the types of diseases that we would see. New Mexico already has a couple of non-attainment ground-level ozone areas in the Four Corners and then down in the southern part of the state. And as we would see increases in emissions, you could expect to see those types of health problems increasing, and so we would see increases in mortality, increases in morbidity, and also lost productivity. So all of those could be costs that would just go along with the increased ground level ozone.
How do people get sick from increased ground level ozone?
Basically, it's going to be mainly through asthma. Would be one of the major things that you would see.
And it's interesting because, well, of course, when we talked about Paul, when we talked to Paul Epstein the other day, he's talking about asthma too, which is a consequence of increased ragweed production. So asthma, as a public health problem, can come from numerous sources, all resulting from changes in climate.
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that there are a number of different ways that you could see increased occurrence.
So another thing is increased heat waves during the summer, hot days and also hot nights, which increases sickness, death, and particularly among the most vulnerable people, including the elderly and the poor, who are less likely to have cooling systems.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, you can see variations on this theme in terms of increased heat. When we have heat waves in major cities in the country, Chicago comes to mind. The last few years, they've seen a couple of different heat waves. And inevitably, during that time, you see an increased number of deaths. You also see increased costs simply because of those vulnerable populations succumbing or being affected by the heat.
I think that brings up another important point, which is that the part of this whole picture is really the potential of worsening inequality and the resulting effects on health and mortality and employment and quality of life. So climate change could really exacerbate social and economic inequality. What does that look like?
You're exactly right. If you look within New Mexico, this report basically was a very basic start using data that was available. And what it comes up with is that by 2020, if the scenario plays out that is included in this report, it would cost the average household in New Mexico about $3,400, which is approximately 8% of the median household income in the state of New Mexico. But what that really obfuscates is the fact that while the median household income in New Mexico is about $43,000, it ranges anywhere from $27,000 in counties like Sierra to a high of $102,000 in Los Alamos. Santa Fe, for instance, is right about $55,000. And so what you would be seeing is, I think, two things. Number one, we have disparities in income to begin with. And so if we're looking at costs of increased health costs and increased energy-related costs and those types of things, you know, that's going to hit lower-income households to start with. Number two, just by the location of some of the counties with lower incomes, we might see, you know, that also exacerbated because of changes in the productivity of crops, changes in the production of milk, which is very important in some of the eastern counties, changes in the production of beef, changes in the production of pecans, for instance. And so I think it's, you know, kind of a double-edged sword there in terms of it's going to hit lower income, and then incomes in the state are fairly diverse depending upon the location.
And so the people, for example, whose incomes are dependent on food production, whether it be milk or beef, all kinds of ranching, farming, there's a whole section in your report on farming in the Rio Grande Valley, people whose incomes are dependent on those things are more likely to suffer when water supply goes down and they're not able to do their job as well or at all.
Certainly, I think that's exactly the case. The water supply decreases, we have increased droughts, we have changes in the temperature patterns, we have changes in when climatic events happen and the severity of those. Any production or any industry that's going to be, you know, somewhat dependent upon the weather or the weather patterns is going to be impacted. And so certainly, you know, the farming and the ranching industries, I think, have the potential for great impact.
And let's not forget fishing. Fishing is something which is also, and trout fishing in particular, pretty severely affected in these projections about climate change.
Yes, it certainly could be, and there would be two different ways that this would be impacted. There is a value that's estimated in terms of reduced trout populations, and that basically basically includes something that's called the willingness to pay, but it would be the value that households put on having specific levels of fish populations. But then there's also the recreational opportunity, where fishing is actually one of the large, the large parts of the value in terms of costs or in terms of increased costs with business as usual.
That's another thing that we should talk about in some detail, which is recreation. The kinds of recreation in New Mexico that would suffer include fishing, as you say, downhill skiing, reservoir use, even camping. All of these things could be affected, and indeed severely affected by climate change.
Certainly. I mean, if you think about it, most of the skiing in New Mexico occurs in the northern part of the state. And right now, if it's a good or not so good skiing season, is going to depend upon the weather patterns and the amount of snow. If we have climate change occurring, which means changes in weather events, temperature, precipitation, you could see much more variation, I think, in the levels of snow that you would get in any year. I think most of the projections would argue that you're going to see a decrease in snowpack, which would very much impact skiing. Certainly fishing, because you're going to have changes in the levels of streams and reservoirs, and then also any reservoir recreation. You know, if we don't have the water to be able to hold in the reservoir, the level of recreation is also going to decline, and that would go for any reservoir across the state.
We're talking to Janie Shermack, professor of economics at the University of New Mexico, about the economic costs of not doing anything at all about climate change, in other words, business as usual. So, back to the basics. Okay, so water supply, when water supply decreases, that happens everywhere, fresh water supply, both in the West and in the rest of the world. Food production is affected, and some of the things that we haven't talked about also are some of the agriculture in the southern part of the state, including, well, let's see, would chili be affected?
Chili could certainly be affected because, again, depending upon the weather conditions in any given year, we see wide variations in chili production, from year to year based on not only the level of precipitation, but also in terms of the pattern of precipitation and the pattern of heat. We have the annual variations right now. As we change the weather patterns and we still have those annual variations, again, I think you could see that to be one of the things that would be affected. Perhaps more importantly, well, not if you're a chili lover, it won't be more importantly, but from an economic perspective, maybe the pecan industry in the southern part of the state, which is one of the, largest producers of pecans in the country. And so as we would see increased temperatures, decreased water availability, that probably would have an extremely adverse effect on pecans, which, unlike chilies, which are an annual crop, are going to be perennial. And so it can have a longer-term effect, I think, in terms of if you decimate the orchards, number one, you may not be able to replant them. And if you even can replant, it could be, a fair amount of time or a lag between planting and actually harvesting.
In which case, a lot of people's livelihoods are severely impacted, and they may not be able to continue doing what they're doing.
Certainly.
What about flood and storm damage? We know about the increase in hurricane risks in coastal areas. What about New Mexico?
Certainly. And again, I think this gets back to what the climatologists would be predicting in terms of the type of events that you would see. And for the most part, I think everything I've read or seen has been that we would expect to have more extreme events, and you would expect to see a shift in when events may occur. And so right now we get snowpack, which feeds the Middle Rio Grande, but we may have a change in, when the precipitation occurs and the severity of that precipitation. And so that means if we shift from snowpack in the winter to rain events and if they are more severe than what we have seen in the last 10 or 20 years, what we would expect to see then would be increased flood and storm damage. So both of those will have a cost associated with that, just in terms of, the cost to mitigate, the cost to clean up, all of the costs that you would expect to see that you see with a flood or storm damage right now.
You've calculated these numbers, and you mentioned a moment ago that 10 years from now, we're looking at an increased cost per family, per household in New Mexico of approximately $3,400. 30 years from now, that goes up to $5,400. And in the year 2080, we're talking about $12,000 per family just for climate change-related expenses if we don't do anything.
Exactly, and that's, you know, the caveat here would be is that it would depend upon the level of emissions being consistent with what the projections are that were used for the scenario. And those go back to the IPCC and one of their scenarios. And so, yeah, as you would see, climate change increase, you would see all of these things increase because we would see increased temperatures, decreased precipitation, changes in precipitation patterns. And so in all cases, you would tend to see increased costs, not only through the changes in the climate change projections, but also as we're going to have increased population. So, you know, not only would you see one of those, but you would see both of those happen. But yes, as it got more severe, you should expect to see larger costs. Now, also I would say that there's, you know, great uncertainty as we go forward 40 or 50 or 70 years. And so, you know, there probably would be a range of values that you might see around that 5,400 or that 12,000, but I would certainly expect them to go up from the 3,400 that we've projected for 2020 if nothing is done or nothing else changes in the status quo.
As I was reading your report, I did this thing which I identify as a kind of typically American thing, which is I thought, well, technology will save us. We'll find a way to, you know, take all these problems and, you know, desalinate seawater and pipe it in from California or some of these crazy things. But even if you start to think that way, you're still getting into very, very expensive and uncertain and as yet unknown possibilities.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that to a large extent has been you know, the attitude that we've always had, and there's an economist named Julian Simon who basically espoused that we always stay one step ahead of disaster because we find a way to technologically mitigate the problem. So, yes, we can have adaptation and change how we do things and change how we insulate our houses and change how we cool them. But, again, all of those things also have costs associated with them. And so if we can stay ahead of the curve, that still doesn't mean that there aren't going to be costs associated with them. I think it's just the fact that we may not know exactly what those costs would be right now. And let me add one other thing. You know, there is, from the climatologist's perspective, I think a tipping point in terms of when we increase emissions and we see the changes in climate, you know, there may be a tipping point at which even if we then start to reduce emissions, we may be past the point of being able to go back to where we were. And so I think that's another part of this that has to be considered, that right now I think trying to put numbers on that would be very, very difficult. But again, it's the problem I think we've had is we all look at it from our own perspective. And so half of the equation is the cost of climate change, and it's expensive, but there's also the cost of doing nothing, and it's expensive. And really, I think it's the idea of there has to be a kind of a holistic evaluation of this, of what are the costs associated with doing something, what are the costs associated with doing nothing, and then in the doing something, is it through, you know, a cap and trade and emissions reduction, is it through technological change and adaptation, or is it some variation between all of those?
And, of course, we're talking about this in advance of the Environmental Improvement Board hearing next week, and we will see whether New Mexico is in fact, in favor of a carbon cap. In many ways, and I think it's important to note all these dire predictions that we're talking about now, it's not what's going to happen. It's the best guess at what's going to happen if we don't do anything. So if we do something, now, let's say 10 years from now, the cost of doing nothing per household is $3,400. What about the cost of preventing climate change? Do you have calculations for that?
You know, there have been a number of costs that have been estimated, and a lot of those costs have been at a a federal level. And what I would say is when you look at those costs that are estimated, and even if you look at the costs that, you know, in the report that we're talking about, you have to look at all of the assumptions that are behind them. And so the cost of doing something, I mean, I can find reports where the cost of doing something is actually a positive net gain to it's going to be, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars per household. And again, I think part of that depends upon the assumptions and the caveats. And a lot of the reports that are out there are also ones that I think are ones where there is a specific result that people would like to see. And so they may be more of an advocacy report, if you will, rather than an unbiased, I would say, economic report. So I could give you numbers, but I really don't know that I think those mean very much. What I would say, I guess, about a lot of the reports in general, it's kind of the what's the direction of impact, are the magnitudes consistent across, you know, a number of reports. And again, those vary so greatly that I'm not sure I really want to cite any of them.
Right, right. I think it is important if people can look at what happens, and this is something that you talk about in your report, what are the consequences of 1 degree centigrade increase in climate change and 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 6. And basically, once you get to a 6 degree or 10 degree Fahrenheit increase in the Earth's temperature, basically it's kind of game over.
I think so. As you know, in terms of what we know or how we live, I would say that's very true. And so then, unless there is something adaptation-wise, technology-wise, there is a point at which I think you're right, game over.
The costs that you talk about in your report, and you're an economist, so you talk about economic costs, but they're also human costs, environmental costs, cultural costs. When you damage systems like trout fishing and skiing and ranching and hiking and farming, you're creating social change, social upheaval, instability, and that has emotional costs, social costs, and also, probably not that easy to calculate, but economic costs.
You're exactly right. And I think one of the things about this report is the costs or the cost categories that are looked at are those costs that, you know, we could find or there was a way to come up with an estimate. But you're right, there's so many things that are what an economist would call a non-market value. And, you know, we know it has value. We know culture has value. But how do you put a price tag on that? And a lot of those things are very, very difficult. And so I think, again, what you would look at in a lot of this is that this may be a, it may be a lower bound, if you will, in terms of here are things that we can calculate. That doesn't mean those other costs are not important, because they are. It's just that there's no way to really get a defensible value for some of those. But if you would think about it, you would simply be able to, not simple, but you would be adding on those additional costs to this, saying that we've come up with this calculated $3,400 per household, or the $1.7 billion for the state, but there are all sorts of uncalculable or costs that have not been measured that also have to be considered. And certainly among those, I think, would be the cultural and, you know, some of the ecological costs that we have not been able to include.
So are economists across the board beginning to see the things that you're talking about? Do you see economists basically sounding the alarm about climate change?
Oh, I think a group of economists have been sounding the alarm for many, many years, quite frankly. There is a subset of economists within the economics community, which would be environmental and resource economists, who spend a large portion of their life trying to estimate the cost of using a resource or estimating the cost of changing the climate or changing the availability of water and things like that. And, you know, I think you've seen a number of people. Bob Stevens would be someone, Harvard, who looks at these things and has been very much at the forefront of saying there are costs associated with this, and you know, we need to look at this from a larger holistic picture.
Jamie Shermack is professor of economics at the University of New Mexico, and she contributed to the report An Overview of Potential Economic Costs to New Mexico of a Business-as-Usual Approach to Climate Change. And that's a mouthful, but I will try to put a link to that on my website, so if people want to take a look at it, they can do so. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome Michael Northrup. He's the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Shirley.
So we've been talking all week about climate change and the economic and environmental and human consequences of not doing anything that we're already seeing and that we will see in much greater measure if we don't make some very big changes. And one of the biggest changes we're looking at in order to avert the worst crisis is massive investment in clean energy technologies and conversion to these technologies away from fossil fuels. So I was hoping that you could help us understand the relationship between government regulation and investment in clean technologies. In other words, what political conditions are necessary for investors to feel secure and willing to invest?
Right. Investors won't invest unless they feel they have a market that is sure. And right now they really don't feel that way about renewable energy in the United States. So that's a problem. And I guess the same would go if you were looking at efficiency markets. We don't have national standards on buildings. We don't have retrofit standards. And in the transportation sector, another big place where clean energy investment could take place, we really don't have enough of an incentive structure for large manufacturing to really build and operate plants in the United States. So it's, you know, it's true across all three of these areas, renewable energy, efficiency, and transportation.
So from the point of view of a venture capitalist who says, I want to do the right thing and I want to invest in, say, solar panels or mass transportation or improved grid efficiency, things like that, what do they want? What are they looking for? And where are they investing?
Well, and more people are investing in other countries because there seems to be more momentum in other parts of the world. Notably China. China's really decided to move forward very rapidly on these issues. And 5 years ago, China didn't have any manufacturing capacity to speak of in the solar or the wind sectors, and now they are producing more wind turbines and solar cells than any other country in the world. You look at places like Europe, it's also happening. There's a great story in the New York Times this week about Portugal, which in 5 years has increased its renewable energy generation from 17% to 45% of total energy generated. It's remarkable what can happen in a short time if you have the right structure in place. In Europe and in China, in the renewable energy space, the tactic that people have employed that seems to be working that we have yet to catch on to is creating a guaranteed purchase contract for renewable energy so that if you're generating power by wind or solar or thermal or biomass, whatever, there's an added increment of price that you can get for your production in order to make sure that it's competitive for you. In Europe, they call it, it's a terrible name, they call them feed-in tariffs, which I think would be a no-go in the United States as a terminology. We'll have to invent another term. But in essence, they're long-term purchase contracts that allow producers to know that they have a stable market. And that means an investor knows that they have a stable market to invest in. It means that a bank can give a loan to an investor in order to build a manufacturing plant. Right now, we live year to year with an investment tax credit structure in the United States that seems to run out, and then there's the kind of a six-month hiatus while Congress decides to renew it or not. It's a horrible situation for a big company trying to invest in building manufacturing plant or trying to hire people to take on the jobs inside those plants. And this is just misery for the U.S. in terms of, you know, building a renewable energy industry in the future.
When you say long-term guaranteed purchase contracts, help us understand that contract. Who is the contract between, and what does it say?
You know, there are many, many ways to do this, so anything I say could be tweaked and improved on, I'm sure. But typically, a utility will allow a small business or a household or a wind generator at a larger scale to manufacture power using wind and will pay them a price that's competitive for that wind. The same would happen in solar or biomass or geothermal or any other technology. And the idea is that that can then be sold into the grid in a way that is economic for the producer. And then that cost is taken on board by the entire rate-paying community inside that utility system. And if you design these things right, it actually adds, you know, really small incremental expenses to any individual's utility bill. And then that small increment of cost spread out over a larger utility customer base can actually pay for a large quantity of power to come into the system that is from renewable energy sources. So Vermont chose last year to do this and enacted a purchase contract system for a variety of renewable energies and chose the number 50 megawatts of power that they wanted to be brought into the system. They estimate that it will be a 1% increase in customers' bills over the course of the year, which, you know, is some people might yell and scream about that, but it actually, you know, is also an investment in jobs and manufacturing in Vermont, which means that in a state that really does need jobs and new business opportunities, all of those are beginning to flock to the state in really remarkable new ways. There was a little city in Florida, Gainesville, Florida. Only 110,000 people in Gainesville. The former mayor, Begin Hanrahan, put in place a small feed-in tariff for solar in her community, but small in relative terms. They actually, in the first year of the program, put online three times as many megawatts of solar power in Gainesville than existed in the entire state. So clearly the policy structure that had been in place was not functioning as well as people would have liked. Policies really do make a difference. I think we could learn a lot from these European techniques to try to bring more of this stuff online and also generate jobs in manufacturing and business enterprises at the same time.
So the tax credit structure that we have tried, or those experiments, have been very weak, not very useful. You talked about these long-term guaranteed purchase contracts. What about the thing that we're considering here in New Mexico, a carbon cap, or cap and trade, or cap and dividend? How do these types of structures affect the possibility of investment?
Well, each of those policies you just mentioned are open to all kinds of interpretation. But at its essence, what a cap would do would be to make sure that only a certain amount of carbon is generated through the utility process, which would mean that the remainder would have to be generated using other forms of clean energy. And, you know, what happens in order to create the incentive so that the pricing structure works for the clean energy generators is the trick. So I think it's a really good thing. What caps are designed to do, cap and trade, cap and dividend, or just a cap, is to actually send a price signal to the market that says that carbon is more expensive than it is in an unregulated market. And if that's the case, then the price of carbon in a dirty fuel goes up, making other forms of renewable energy more cost competitive. And so price signals are exactly the kinds of things that we should be enacting all across the country. Carbon taxes and other mechanisms to do the same thing. We tend to think carbon taxes are not as politically palatable in the United States because of the tax word. And that's why people have tried to figure out a way to make this cap and trade system work in Washington. But that also seems to have really backfired in the last several months, unfortunately.
One of the things that I think is important just to mention here, and this is a term that you use in some of the articles that you've written, is that it's very important to have science-based legislation. In other words, you can't really compromise when a limit is set by the gigantic vast majority of scientists who are looking at this, at the numbers. For example, we talked yesterday to Bill McKibben, who talked about the 350 parts per million limit. Why do you think that the United States has not really embraced the science of global warming in the political process?
One, it's been hard for people to take on board the seriousness of the issue. There's no doubt about that. It is hard to understand it unless you're a scientist. And the problem seems to have been getting worse as we've been talking about it more seriously. I remember, you know, in 2005 when Tony Blair suggested that we could get the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom said that, you know, what we really needed was a 50% cut in emissions by 2050 in order to make the worst case scenario of climate change not come true. Scientists now think that it's actually sped up the warming in the atmosphere to a degree that they had not imagined. And so they're now saying, well, you know, we need an 80% cut by 2050. Some people are saying we need, you know, even more than that. And it makes it even more difficult to take on board. So there is those goalposts are moving. There's a lack of kind of comprehension of the seriousness of this. And then there's a very well-organized, well-funded set of status quo interests who are doing just fine, thank you, you know, generating power using coal and other dirty fossil fuels, who feel that their way of life and their economies are threatened if we do anything to change that. And so they're resisting like mad. And unfortunately, they are extremely well-funded and deep-pocketed. And, you know, if a politician has one political interest to be concerned about in their jurisdiction, it's often the utility. So if utilities are not really pushing for this, it makes it much harder. And most utilities are not pushing for this. They're really fighting hard to make sure that we don't go in this direction and create this kind of change. So it's a pretty tough situation for an advocate for the significant kind of change that we're talking about. Change is always scary. And in this situation, it's, you know, particularly scary, and it's not even understood. And people are saying that the people who are calling for these changes are, you know, all kooks and nuts. And they're very organized about saying that, which puts a lot of doubt in people's heads. So it's a tough situation, unfortunately.
We're talking to Michael Northrup. He's the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. So you have been talking about, you use the term in one of your articles, clean energy gold rush. And the United States is way behind. As you mentioned, China and other countries are far ahead in claiming those markets. What are those markets? What falls under the category of clean energy in this gold rush?
Well, people have assumed that this was a big market. And then last fall, the big global multinational bank, HSBC, came out with a report, which I found staggering. They looked around the world to try to figure out how big this clean energy sector was and came up with a just absolutely amazing number. They counted a $500 billion annual market for clean energy. About 75% of that was generation, about a quarter of it was efficiency, and there's some miscellaneous in there too. So it's all the things we're talking about. And it's a market segment that's bigger than the global aerospace or defense sectors combined. It's really big, and there aren't too many of these out there. So they said that in 2009 it had already reached a $500 billion a year level. And they predicted, after a lot of analysis, and I think it's right, that in 10 years, by 2020, in 10 years, that marketplace will be $2 trillion a year. So there'll be three more of these $500 billion market segments out there. You know, you look at the United States now in its somewhat wounded economic state. Boy, you know, wouldn't it be great for us to be vying for that marketplace and trying to take advantage of it? And it is really striking how fast places like China have begun to move on this, and some of the Europeans as well, like the Portuguese example I mentioned earlier, a small country. But, you know, the Germans and the UK are doing the same thing. Many other European countries are as well. We should be jumping for those markets. This is the future economy the United States should be owning. we use 25% of the world's energy. Think of 25% of $2 trillion. It would be one of those $500 billion market segments. And we should be owning that. And if we really are the manufacturing powerhouse that we think we are, we should be owning more than that. And unfortunately now, we don't have a national goal. We don't have a national policy, really, to even do this. We have none of the incentive systems that can really take this on in a big way. You know, you just look at the manufacturing segments in this space. You know, in wind, we have one of the 10 largest wind manufacturers in the world in the United States, and that's General Electric. We have two of the 10 largest solar manufacturers in the world, but both of them do most of their manufacturing in China. And we're nowhere in the other segments. You know, if we're going to really own these manufacturing segments and generate the jobs and the income and the dividends from this gigantic economic development opportunity, we've really got to get started or we're going to fall behind. And not only will we be shipping our oil dollars to the Middle East, we'll be shipping all our wind and solar dollars to China, too. And that's just unacceptable. We just have to say as a country we're going to do something about this and put these structures in place.
So basically, if I understand all of this correctly, what it looks like is a country, whether it be the United States or somebody else, institutes public policy that is conducive to clean energy development and efficiency. Then that makes it conducive for companies to invest huge, almost incomprehensible amounts of money in clean energy. And then we can get off fossil fuels. And the only reason we don't do this is because the fossil fuel lobbies are too strong and we don't have campaign finance reform.
Yeah, campaign finance reform is going to make it even more difficult now when you think of the kinds of money that the oil and coal industries have poured into stopping Senate action on global warming this year. You know, and you think about the most recent Supreme Court ruling that, you know, really allows now for unlimited campaign contributions by private interests, it's going to be even tougher to move this ball down the court. So it's worrisome. I guess what we need to count on is that people will wake up to the things that Bill McKibben is saying about the urgency of this situation. In the middle of a summer where we are seeing fires in Russia and heat waves that they've never seen before and floods in Asia and all kinds of other natural phenomena that are the kinds of things that are going to get produced by a warming world, you know, it is just insane that we're not connecting the dots, getting more worried and putting these policies in place that will allow us to become, you know, the giant engine for the clean energy marketplace of the future.
You lecture part of the time at the Yale University Forest and Environmental Studies School. For all of my life, there's been a really, I guess you would say, uneasy relationship between commerce and environmentalism. They're kind of pitted against each other, and part of that is real, and part of it is the media, but there's this kind of mythology that what's good for the environment is bad for business and vice versa. That seems to be ingrained in American culture. Right now, from what you're saying, we're looking at a very different picture where if we follow the pure capitalist direction of stimulating the greatest amount of investment in this huge market, we're actually helping the environment.
Yeah, it's people have said this for a long time, and many have chosen not to believe it, but it really is so clear to me now that the greatest incentive for building a vibrant economy in the United States right now is the climate change imperative. You know, and what an interesting, you know, situation to have found ourselves in. You see now people catching on to that, like HSBC and Deutsche Bank and, you know, other big investors who are now out saying, this is our future, guys. Let's get it together. Stop this bipartisan wrangling. Meeting our obligations to the planet is the same as meeting our obligations to our economy. We've just got to be doing this. You know, I'm heartened as I look around the country now by people who are from kind of the economic development community who are catching on to this and recognizing that climate change is the biggest economic opportunity they've seen in their lifetime. There's a real contrast between what you hear from the National Chamber of Commerce in Washington, which tends to be very, very kind of knee-jerk anti-anything that sounds like it's environmental, and a lot of their brethren at the local and state levels around the country who are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, this is a big opportunity. Let's get on board. Let's figure out a way to do this stuff and get this money into our local economies the way Pagin Hanrahan in Gainesville, Florida has, and the way politicians and economic developers in Vermont have, and certainly the way, you know, leading states like California have. But people are beginning to catch on, and you do hear it more and more from mayors and from governors who actually have the hands-on empirical experience of trying to do these kinds of quote-unquote climate change policies or clean energy policies. They keep finding that they're getting jobs and savings and all kinds of other benefits from doing so as well. So, you know, it often takes a while in this very large country for that kind of information to filter from the local and state level into the federal policy arena. It seems to be taking especially long as we kind of watch the urgency of climate change develop. But, you know, I am heartened by what I see happening at the local and state level around the country, and I do think that voices of reason from those levels are going to transcend the sort of partisan bitterness and say, hey, come on, let's just get practical and get on with this and stop the fighting and let's just do it and build our economy while we do so.
Well, you're in New York and you work with business people and bankers at the highest level. I mean, does the business community that you interact with have any idea of how urgent the situation is and what the timeline is?
I think some do. I mean, they've got their own urgent timeline, which is often a quarterly timeline, so it's hard to focus on things too far afield sometimes. But you do see it. I mean, there's a remarkable network of investors and businesses that has been operating under a banner called the We Can Lead campaign. You know, they have better things to do. They all need to run their businesses, but they have actually come together to say, please, 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 federal lawmakers, stop the bitter wrangling. Let's get on board and do something about this because this is our future. And, you know, they are so concerned about it, they've actually been traveling into Washington, D.C. to meet with senators and congressmen. You know, that's another one of those good signs of kind of local good sense just rising up and going to Washington to kind of shake people up and say, come on, let's do something real here and do the right thing. So I am seeing more and more interest in the private sector along these lines. You know, it's been a little bit hard the last 2 years with the economy in shambles for people to be doing it everywhere in the American business community. But I do think that this We Can Lead effort by businesses in, at last count, something like 40 states is really a great harbinger of what I think we'll see more and more of, particularly as the economy hopefully picks up some steam and people get a little bit more time to think about things outside of escaping bankruptcy proceedings and other bad things during this horrible economic time.
Michael Northrup is the director of the Sustainable Development Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund in New York City. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks, Mary Charlotte. Real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take another quick little break right now. Please stay tuned. John Fogarty will be back for the last couple of minutes of the show. We've been talking all this week about climate change, and John Fogarty is joining us once again in the cafe just for the last few minutes of this program and of this series.
Good morning again, Mary Charlotte.
So we've covered a lot of ground this week, and all of this in advance of the petition in front of the Environmental Improvement Board on starting on Monday of next week, the 16th of August, to cap carbon emissions in New Mexico. I just wanted to give you the last word.
I just to say, wow, what an incredible week. The way that you went into depth about the problem that we face, the way that we need to solve this, I want to say thank you. And thanks to all your listeners out there for exploring this. On Monday, your listeners have an opportunity to get involved. People of Santa Fe, people around Santa Fe have an opportunity to do something about climate change. I think it's rare. It's such a global problem. It's rare where people can get involved and do something. We're encouraging people to come out to the hearings at the Environmental Improvement Board. They started Monday, 10 o'clock in the morning, at the Para Building near the Outlet Mall.
So it's not the regular Para Building. It's the so-called new Para Building.
Exactly, on Cirios Road.
And down by the Outlet Malls. I've never
been there.
Down by the
Outlet Mall. There's a frontage road there. It's 33 Plaza La Prensa. And you can go to the website, newenergyeconomy.org, and learn more about the case, learn more about the hearings, and come out and support it.
John Fogarty is with New Energy Economy. Once again, newenergyeconomy.org. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.